Congress of the United States to hear the State of the Union message by the President. He's even been able to sit in on debates between presidential candidates, and I suppose you might even say participate in moon landings by being there when an astronaut sets foot on the surface of the moon. I think all of this has been very much to the good. I think another thing that broadcasting has done, in addition to reaching parts of the audience which were not reached in the past by newspapers, it also has served fairly well to clarify complex issues. I think some of the devices used by the networks to explain the meaning of inflation, for example, have been useful. I think the energy story has been well explained, particularly by the networks. In general, I think this country, at least, has profited enormously from the fact that enormous resources have been put into news broadcasting, both on the by the networks and the local stations. On the other hand, it seems to me that we are now in a position where most broadcasters do have a sense of responsibility to the public. I think they feel deeply the fact that they sit in positions of power, and that that power can be used for the good if they devote the right judgment to it. I think there's a danger that in another generation we might have a different generation of owners and managers. We might have a generation, or at least some cases within a new generation, that has less of this sense of public responsibility that the present owners and managers have. I think we might have executives who would be more willing to bend the power of the medium to their own personal uses and their own personal welfare. This, you can argue, would be restrained by federal regulation, but you know, it really can't be by federal regulation. There are too many things that could be done which would be disadvantageous or actually dangerous to the public welfare without in any way coming in conflict with the federal regulatory rules. As a matter of fact, we'd probably be better off without those federal regulatory rules, letting the marketplace decide. But as the competition again for ratings and for dollars goes on, and as managers, owners, executives find more and more that the medium does have a great deal of power, it would be pretty difficult to restrain an individual owner from making use of it. I think we came dangerously close to it on occasions, even in the use of Section 315. We had to make the decision frequently who is a candidate and who isn't a candidate, because there isn't any clear-cut way of deciding. I had to withdraw an invitation from Hubert Humphrey at one point to appear and face the nation, because it was decided in a general management meeting that because his name had been put in the race by Senator McCarthy, Gene McCarthy, and Orville Freeman, that he was therefore a candidate, we couldn't give him the time and face the nation. Well, you see, this power, which is written into the legislation of the country, could very well be used. Those decisions could be made, those interpretations made, in such a way to serve the personal interests of the individual or the private interests of a corporation. And I think this is a danger for the future that we have to guard against. And I don't know of any way of guarding against it except to hope that the people who get into the business and rise to positions of power and will be public-spirited citizens. I don't think the program network, for example, which created quite a commotion within the last 2 or 3 years in this country, is at all representative of what might happen. But if the ratings wars became too intense, I can see that in those intensive rating wars, there could be a reduction in the high standards which now prevail. But what's the next generation of news broadcasters, for example, going to be? When Walter Cronkite drops out of the position, when he retires, which may happen very soon, is CBS then going to decide that it's got to stay in the ratings race? Is it going to have to find a successor to Walter Cronkite who is there principally because he's able to get ratings, or principally because he's a man of substance and of news judgment? This is a danger. As of now, I think CBS, in all probability, will put into that position when Cronkite leaves a genuine, self-respecting newsman. But if the competition gets too severe at some time in the future, what might happen? We've seen disintegration in some local communities. because of the competition for ratings points and for profits, that could even at some time, perhaps, it's unlikely, but it could extend to the networks. In other words, I think that broadcasters have got to band together to maintain some kind of high standards. And I don't think you can talk in terms of any rules and regulations that must be imposed on them, but there has to be this combined attitude, which it feeds on itself, of maintaining this sense of standards, sense of public responsibility, sense of public obligation, so that the institution of broadcasting, with all the power which it can wield, doesn't get away from its present high standards. I think that perhaps is the most important thing. I've seen many cases where we've been close to performing acts, to broadcasting in a way which could be dangerous to the general public. But I think generally we were able to restore a sense of genuine responsibility. And that having seen how close you can get to the precipice on occasion, I just have a feeling that it's important that people realize that, and that they keep on convincing themselves that the standards have got to be held high.
In your book, The Electric Eye, you had a number of interesting things to say about the mix of politics and broadcasting. Since you wrote that book, have you changed any of your attitudes on this subject?
Well, I think I have. I think I now have quite mixed feelings about the relationship of politics and television. I think the book reflected the beginning of a change in attitude from that early period when we were absolutely euphoric about what television was going to do to the whole political process. You know, we went into that campaign of 1952 convinced that we had the most magnificent new device that had ever been created. A device that would bring politics literally into the living room, a device that would make candidates become real human beings, much more than just cold characters in print or on the radio, to all of the electorate, that would bring out voters in the masses, which we'd never heard of before. And the result of all of this would be a functioning of pure democracy. We even talked about television bringing us as close as we could get in the modern era to the Greek city-state. We projected the idea that democracy can extend out as far as a man's voice can carry. And we said now that we have the combination of pictures and sound of a man's voice and his appearance literally carried to the four corners of the country, and therefore we can extend democracy to the four corners of the country. Now I'm not so sure. I begin to wonder. The problem, of course, is that the percentage of voters going to the polls actually rose dramatically. In 1952, the first year of television, it held fairly level in 1956, which was really a dull election year when there was not the slightest doubt in anybody's mind that Eisenhower would defeat Stevenson. It rose to a new high level in 1960 in the famous Kennedy-Nixon campaign. And then it started to plummet immediately after 1960. It's been going downhill ever since. And you begin to wonder why. Now television has gotten to the point where we have something like 97% saturation. More than 100 million persons listen to the political campaigns. There are really large audiences for presidential messages. There were presidential debates in 1976 that drew large audiences. Here, candidates, Ford and Carter in action, then the logical outcome of the thing would be a greater sense of participation in politics. That hasn't happened. There must be some reason why it hasn't happened. And I suppose if you go back over the history of television and try to do an analysis of what television really is, you may be able to find it. Now, I have a feeling, perhaps, that for all that Marshall McLuhan writes, it is a little difficult to stomach. At the same time, when he talks about the cool medium, and what other persons refer to television as a medium that doesn't demand any active participation on the part of the viewer, that perhaps television has a tendency to make a suit on it. To put the average viewer, listener, instead of developing enthusiasm for participation in the electoral process, instead of demanding that you know more about the process and about the candidates and about the issues, instead of insisting on going to the polls, he becomes bored by the whole process. I have no evidence to prove that hypothesis, but I have a feeling that something of that sort may be happening. I also wonder whether television hasn't had a tendency to oversimplify issues, oversimplify an approach to the point where the public thinks that everything can be solved by television. It all seems so simple on television, and then they find out that inflation keeps on developing, prices grow higher in the grocery stores, gasoline becomes more difficult to get to the cars, life becomes more complex and more difficult, and what they've learned in television hasn't helped them any, and there's a sense of frustration. It seems to me that something of that sort may be happening. And that this isn't necessarily due exclusively to television's coverage of the political campaign, but it's also due to the day-to-day pressure which results from watching television on a regular basis. The viewer, it is quite conceivable, goes to television more and more in the news broadcasts for a quick glance at what is happening, catches the superficial overview of the news without any real involvement in it, vicarious or otherwise, without any attachment to it, and he's become inured to what happens on the television screen, and his nerve endings have been deadened, and he no longer responds as he used to great distance. Now, it'll take some time before we find out more about an hypothesis of this sort, but so far, it is certainly true that everything we said about television as an adjunct and an aid to political campaigning and the more efficient function of democracy has been badly exaggerated, very seriously exaggerated. Now, as to the influence of the campaign, I think something of the same sort is true. I remember all the brave statements we made in 1952, 53, 54. We said campaigns were going to be shorter. There was no need for a long campaign. Long campaigns have actually gotten longer. We announced, for example, that it wasn't going to be necessary any longer to get out and shake hands. Well, that's been true. But the campaign actually has taken a different form. Rather than the big public speech in the auditorium, which is heard on radio by thousands or hundreds of thousands of persons, the campaigners have taken to the jet airplane, and now they do 2, 3, 4 media appearances a day. They fly by jet from city to city and go to their shopping centers, to big supermarkets and the like, and do their campaigning there. Out of that, they also do media play on the television news broadcasts. Now, you can't give television part of the credit for doing that, but the jet airplane has been tremendously important. If it hadn't been for the jet airplane, we might still be, even with television, campaigning in the same old way. As to expenses in campaigns, the most recent Federal Election Campaign Act has, by cutting down on total expenditures, substantially raise the percentage of the candidates' expenses which go toward television. But at the same time, another factor has come along, the use of the computer and direct mail. And now, I suppose, in the minds of most campaign executives, the computer and direct mail are considered actually almost as important as the early evening news broadcast. So that the predictions, again, not come true in their entirety, because there have been other factors. The jet airplane and the computer have a tendency to reduce to a considerable extent the emphasis that was, we thought was going to be placed on television. So I really seriously have mixed feelings, and I wonder if we have generally benefited, as we thought we would, from the participation of television in the whole electoral campaign governmental.
If television has contributed so greatly to the kind of political apathy we've noticed in the last 10 or 15 years, is there something that the television industry could be doing or should be doing to jar us out of this complacency?
Well, I'm afraid there may be certain built-in disadvantages to the use of television, which means that you can't completely overcome it, but I think there are certain things that can be done. I think the networks and the regular news broadcasts in the last few years have been doing an absolutely superb job of handling serious news and not getting too concerned about chasing after the will-o'-the-wisp of the film, for example. They're approaching news seriously, responsibly. They're making an effort to present hard news interestingly and understandably to the public. I think that's a step forward, and I think it may do very well in overcoming some of the part of the apathy in the future. I'm afraid that many local stations, however, have taken the view that the ratings you get out of news are much more important than the information which you communicate. The ratings, of course, are immediately transferable into dollars, and the dollars in gross income are translatable into net profits. And as a consequence, in too many cases, in my opinion, local stations have permitted themselves the luxury of creating their news broadcasts with largely an entertainment image rather than an information communication image. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I think this fact contributes to the apathy in the sense that news becomes entertainment. There's a tendency to shy away from anything which is difficult or serious to explain or relates to serious problems which affect the individual, and news becomes rather a sort of a montage of accidents and fires and crime and soft feature stories, and in some cases Chamber of Commerce puffs and extended weather broadcasts and extended sports broadcasts, and it never gets around to grappling with the hard facts of life and the difficult-to-picture news stories which are developing all the time in boards of education, planning and zoning commissions, in the bureaus which maintain crime statistics, in the urban redevelopment processes, and that sort of thing. I'm not sure how much good it would do to beef up these broadcasts and redirect them toward more serious news. It would be costly, undoubtedly. It would cost station operators at least a substantial amount of investment in larger staffs. It might be damaging to some extent in the competitive battle for ratings. But in the long haul, it seems to me it would serve not only the community, but also the station operators well, in that it would create an aura around the station, an aura of public responsibility, an aura of public service, which I'm quite convinced the evidence will show from past examples can be converted into net profits.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned the use of computers in political campaigns. Could you comment on that and how it's used in conjunction with television coverage?
Well, I've been particularly concerned in the past with the manner in which it's used for projecting outcomes in elections. I'm not concerned to the extent that I'd want to withdraw the computer from the television in any way, but there has been a lot of complaint. For example, there's been a complaint from the West Coast to the effect that most of the national elections are already buttoned up before the polls close in California, Washington, and Oregon because of the three-hour time gap between the East Coast and West Coast. Actually, I've been seriously interested in this whole business about projection of election returns for a long time. Before I moved into New York, when I was still at WCCO in Minneapolis, the CBS home station at Peter Mann, I did most of the election coverage on my own as the head of the news department there. And by some careful study in statistics, I came up with conclusions which parallel those by the statisticians. I found, for example, in the Minnesota area that a candidate who got about 56% in Hennepin County, which included Minneapolis, 58% of Ramsey County, including St. Paul, and about 58% of St. Louis County, including Duluth, I was almost certain to be the winner. If a Democrat got those percentages, he was in. There wasn't much of any doubt about it. But I've also found out that there were some counties, some precincts down in the southern border of the state in relatively wealthy areas that normally voted between 85% 10% Republican to 90% Republican. Well, it occurred to me that if one of those precincts had come in with 75% Republican instead of 85 or 90%, that was a pretty good indication that the Republicans were losing. Well, I checked it out in 1948, the Mason Special Office of Government Precincts, and found out that that's precisely what happened. We knew well before anybody else did that Tom Huey was in serious trouble in the Middle West, and that Hubert Humphrey had knocked off very popular Republican Senator Joe Ball in that state. Well, when I got into New York, after the conclusion of the 1952 conventions, our public special events chief, Paul Levitan, came one day and told me that if we could use Unibank to project the returns in that election. Unibank at that time had only one or two units built. IBM was just barely getting into the computer business. But having some idea from the Minneapolis experience of what we could do, I jumped at it and said, let's go. So we did use the computer to project the election returns in 1952. And actually, by 8:30 at night, hit it on the nose. Unibank reported that the odds are 100-1 that Eisenhower was going to win the election. And within 4 or 5 electoral votes of the total that Eisenhower would receive. And we never had this on the air for a curious reason. The statistician, Remington Rand, had employed, was a Stevenson man, and he was convinced that Stevenson was going to win. And when he saw the odds of 100-1, said to himself that there must be some error in this whole process, which was haphazard at best. So he juggled his correction factors around a little bit and added in some new data for New York State, and somebody in the process of adding in New York State data added an extra zero on the end of the Stevenson vote in New York State. So at about 8:45, we got a report that Eisenhower was going to win by 8-7, well, by that time we knew that Eisenhower hadn't won the bag anyway. But this was a beginning. Now, this was only a beginning. We caught a lot of flack after that from a number of sources, including Scotty Rustin from the New York Times. He wrote a number of columns in which he interviewed Unibank, the all-knowing device, which could predict what anybody was going to do. But we were convinced that we had something important, although it had been haphazard, and we put it all together in about 6 or 8 weeks' time. But we went ahead, and of course the main use of the computer for this purpose is not necessarily just to predict how the election is going to come out, but it's rather to try to find out how people respond to various issues. So by the time 1960 came around, we could refine the whole process in considerable detail and move from Unibank to IBM. And in the primaries, for example, we're able to find out how ethnic groups were reacting to the candidates in the primary. Finding out how social conditions were causing voters to respond. In the Wisconsin primary, for example, we discovered that in the race between Kennedy and Humphrey, that Kennedy was very strong with the wealthier German Catholic farmers, very strong with the urban Polish city workers, that Humphrey's strength was largely with the poorer farmers, poorer northwestern portion of the state who were mostly Protestant. But we were able to project that later into West Virginia and to other states for the two candidates. And we're able to come to a pretty good reading of what the public mood was during this period. Now, I don't think any damage was done by that at all, and I think actually the country is probably generally driven by that. Television personnel have become very adept at the use of the computer for purposes of analyzing in an election campaign and on election night, voter preferences and being able to project. There have been some studies made about projections, nothing I guess is definitive at this point, but the data that's been unearthed so far has indicated that Californians are simply not affected by early returns or early projections from the East. They still go ahead and vote their own impressions and their own attitudes. So it seems quite likely that no damage is done. I cite this because it was really television that brought this new wrinkle into the process of government politics, particularly in the coverage of election night. Newspapers had their gallant tones and their charisma. cones and their rubber cones run in advance. But it was television that changed the whole process of covering the election by gathering returns faster and by running projections during the evening as the evening went along. And it compelled a lot of attention, attracted a lot of attention to itself as a result. And in that respect, I think that's performed a genuine service for the public.
This tape has been an interview with Mr. Sig Nicholson, who is now the Distinguished Visiting Lecturer in the Telecommunications and Film Department. The interviewer has been Elizabeth Hyten, Professor of Telecommunications and Film, San Diego State University. Today's date is March 13, 1979.